Hey, this is Lawrence with a quick content warning. This episode and our discussion of it both deal somewhat heavily with sexual violence, not in a super graphic way, but if hearing about it at all is going to, you know, bum you out, we've got a lot of other episodes to check out in the back catalog, and no harm in skipping out on something that's going to make you sad. Or please enjoy this episode. My name is Lawrence Allen.
I'm Ronald Shaw.
I'm Rahul Vora.
And this is Bad Time Radio. Welcome to another episode of Bad Time Radio. First, before we get down to business, we actually have a guest. I'd like to introduce you all to Dr. Claude Myron Guzer, public intellectual and co-host of the incredible Cannonball Co-host, with Cannon spelled C-A-N-O-N, where he and his co-host Dan discuss the classics of Western literature in a particularly erudite manner that would come as quite the shock to the people who sort of ingest this swill several times a week. And we're going to be covering an episode of Fear on Four, which is called By the River Fontainebleau. And this was actually one that Claude picked. So, Claude, I gave you a couple of options. I believe it was this, and then a really weird 1970s adaptation of The Mask of the Red Death, which I thought might be up your alley because of the whole, you know, cannonball classic Western literature thing. And you chose this. Any reason?
Well, yeah. I mean, I want to hear the Red Death one, just because I'm always fascinated by adaptations. Like when you're adapting something, you're sort of tweaking it, you're playing with it, you're working around something. So I'd love to hear what they would do with like an audio version of that. but this one kind of hit a sweet spot. My like one of my own personal fascinations is with aesthetics and aestheticism. I've studied a lot of, you know, art for art's sake and 19th century decadence aestheticism, because it bleeds into modernism, which is kind of like my field. And I kind of love the sort of horror aspects of aestheticism. And that's, I read the synopsis or the description of what this was, and I was like, oh yeah, this is right up my alley. This is like taking Oscar Wilde and going all goth with it. And so I'm like, yeah, this is pretty cool.
Ah, so a much more erudite answer than one. Why I listened to this one first was that I thought Fontainebleau was a weird word, and I was curious why it was like punctuated the way it was. Anyways, so this is from Fear on Four, which is a British series that aired 7 seasons between 1988 and 1997. It appears to have aired about 48 episodes, although I'm not as sure of that as I would like. And it's actually a sort of a revival of an earlier series called Appointment with Fear that aired in the 60s, or I believe actually it was the 50s. And then Fear on Four, in turn, was later revived by Mark Gatiss, who is a sort of famous actor and also very famous for being behind the Sherlock reboot. And that reimagining is called The Man in Black, which started in 2009. I didn't care for the episode of Appointment with Fear that I heard. I thought it was pretty pokey, although I did only hear one, and maybe I picked a bum one. And The Man in Black is kind of a mixed series. It's got a few standout episodes. If you're interested in it, we actually have a bonus episode that you should be able to find in our archive at this point to check out if you're wondering what's up with The Man in Black. We picked an especially goofy one where a computer eats a man. In contrast, Fear on Four is probably, it may not be the greatest English literature horror radio drama ever made, but it's definitely in the running. The only other thing I know that can touch it is Quiet Please, and it has the advantage over Quiet Please of being a bit more modern, so it's a little bit easier for you to get into, and also the sound quality is much, much better. There are episodes of Quiet Please where it's very hard to figure out what's going on. The episodes are basically all classics, aside from a small drop in quality in the last season, and like this one, they're just incredibly efficient stories, very, very creepy, very, very nasty, and really get under your skin. They also tend to be incredibly just downer endings all over the place. I once compared them to Michael Haneke movies. I think that's a little bit of a misstatement because they're not quite as like formally chilly, but they are still like sort of in the same vein of just hating their characters and also low-key the audience. I don't think the series ever aspired to say big things about the world, but it told stories incredibly well. And this is the seventh episode of the first season. It's written by Peter Gallagher, adapted from his own short story, which I can't find anywhere, although I'd be very curious. And it's directed by Martin Jenkins, who I believe was sort of behind the whole reboot. Aside from that, I actually was curious enough about this that I looked up the cast a little bit. And the main character, Antoine, is played by Kim Wall, who is actually well enough known to have his own Wikipedia page, although it mostly just lists the British comedy series he was in like the 70s and 80s. So with that out of the way, let's go ahead. And would you guys recommend this episode? I'll start. I would very strongly. I think that this hits incredibly hard. Having listened to it a couple of times, I think there's a little bit of weirdness to its story and maybe a couple of things I quibble with, maybe, but it's still incredibly well done and will freak you out. And let's go around. So, Ronald, what did you think of it?
Yeah, so recommending this is kind of hard because this is a pretty brutal episode. This is not something that I would like go into lightly, I guess. If you're looking for horror, I think it was really well written. It's really good. It's something that it's not really scary. It's not terrifying, but it is horrifying. So yes, I'd recommend it, but you know, with some I guess a little bit of footnotes there.
Rahul, what did you think?
Yeah, I'd recommend it. Pretty creepy. Kind of reminded me of Silent Hill for some reason. Got that kind of vibe from it. Or like, I don't know, Resident Evil and some old village and weird stuff. It's going down. Yeah, I recommend it.
And Clot?
Excuse me. Yeah, I would. It's, I think y'all are kind of pegging it for reasons that we'll probably get to in the summary. It reminded me a little bit of sort of like the new French extreme, like some of the films that have come out, like Martyrs and I think it's Calgary.
Or that Chaos one with Vincent Cassel.
Yeah. It reminded me of that, well, one, it takes place in France, but two, it's also... Yeah. Kind of got that vibe, that energy, that there's this like slow burn, something building, something ominous underneath. There's a rural place with its own traditions, with its own things that it does that it's just gonna do regardless. And it kind of hit home, I guess, as we were sort of discussing off air. I've moved back to the rural South, or the semi-rural South, or I guess the suburban South. And it dredged up a lot of stuff, not necessarily the kind of stuff in this episode, but it dredged up some stuff. What is it like to be in a place with its own weird, creepy traditions that are not going to be altered, you know? So, yeah, that's really sort of a thing that can get under your skin.
Now I'm so curious about the creepy traditions that you're talking about.
It's called it's called Monument Avenue in Richmond. Go look it up.
Okay, I will.
God damn it.
Okay, Monument Avenue in Richmond is growing up. Sorry, you said we can digress, so I'm going to digress.
No. That is sort of the point of this episode.
It's kind of like the in Richmond. It's sort of like Richmond's equivalent of Broadway. It's sort of like four lanes of road that sort of like cuts right through the middle of the town. And in the early 20th century, they put up all these gigantic. You know, monuments to all of Virginia's fallen Civil War heroes, whether they were from Virginia or not, hence the gigantic display of Jefferson Davis that starts the monuments, essentially. And right after that is Stonewall Jackson, I believe. And then after that is this gigantic statue of Robert E. Lee on his horse, and it's an extraordinarily realistic horse, right down to the penis. And so it extends. I mean, like buddies of mine in high school used to go and just sort of get high and laugh at the horse's dick. But anyway, it extends like all the way down the road with all of these. You know, these are the great Confederate dead, and it was all put up in the early 20th century. Like long after the Civil War, as part of like this Jim Crow effort to, you know, enshrine the myth of the lost cause. And in the 90s, after Arthur Ashe died, because Arthur Ashe was from, he was from Virginia and sort of got his start in a bunch of the country clubs and really pushed to let them, let him play. After Arthur Ashe died, they put up a statue to Arthur Ashe. And it was a big deal because this was the first, really the first non-Confederate, but also the first African-American on Monument Avenue. It was really something to be celebrated, except everybody wanted to take the statue down after they put it up, half the town because they were just racist jerks, and then the other half of the town because the statue really was very poorly designed. It's a bad looking statue.
It's a bad statue. So that's unfortunate.
But after, you know, I guess Richmond has made some progress after a lot of the protests last summer. They went over to Monument, the protesters went over to Monument Avenue and beautifully vandalized, just graffiti tagged. I know that they did the Robert E. Lee monument, and it's gorgeous now. And so that convinced everybody we've got to take these things down. And so
it's tagged as one of those cool S's.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, it's, do you remember what the parts of the Berlin Wall looked like the western side of the Berlin Wall?
It's, and like, it's like everybody's like spray painted up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like that, man. And so I think they're going to chisel these dumb bastards down, and I think we're better for it. But that's what we're talking about.
You know, I'm
pretty scary at night, man. That'd be really scary, I feel.
I'm kind of two minds on the Confederate monument issue. Because, like, on the one hand, the Confederacy was, like, up there with Nazi Germany in terms of, like, the worst societies that have ever existed. And the fact that so many people were willing to die to defend it is a national disgrace. And even people who are like, well, a lot of the army was drafted. You could desert, you know. But on the other hand, public toilets are really important, and we could use some more of them.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to...
Oh, I get it.
It's a thinker, and it's not...
public toilets.
It's a thinker, and I'm not sure it's worth thinking about, but it is there.
Well, you know, I was talking to my co-host, Daniel, who's much deeper south than I am, and he's steeped in, you know, all of this stuff. And he is the antithesis of your, you know, neo-Confederate, you know, lost cause. He has so much cynical disdain for all of that shit. And I was texting him one time. I was like, hey, man, all right, serious question. You know, the whole idea of a leisure class is supposed to be that somebody else is doing the labor so that we can come up with all the great sort of intellectual innovations and stuff like that. What exactly did the Southern planter aristocracy come up with? They left nothing. You know, it's like, what was the point of that? Aside from, you know, cotillions and coming out parties, debutantes balls.
Yeah. A bunch of weird arguments about why black people aren't actually human, so it's okay. They published an enormous amount of pseudoscience on that topic.
Yeah, aside from that, what... Okay, anyway, I'm sorry.
You're right. There's no, I can't think of any like Southern slave owner who entered the literary canon. I guess there are some people who are trying to like sort of grapple with the legacy, you know, the whole like 1920s, 1930s.
Yeah, like Faulkner, so on and so forth. But yeah, anyway, but I digress.
Yeah. Anyways, you guys want to roll for the summary?
I think I should probably take myself out of the running for the summary because I'm not confident I could do it justice.
Okay, so it's just down to me and Ronald. Okay, Ronald, do you want even and odd, or do you want high and or low?
Whatever.
Okay, I'm going to give you even.
Cool.
And it is 2, so that's you, buddy.
Okay, you guys are going to have to help me out.
Yeah, I have notes, and Claude, as you guys can see, is real smart, which, it's got to be jarring to the listener. Especially when we start busting out some of our patented, this is what you should eat if you want to fuck a woman for 8 hours, and Claude's over here, like, reflecting on the deep, like, legacy of the Confederacy.
No, wait, go on.
What is the answer to that?
Okay, this is a callback to our first episode, but we determined that if you want to fuck a woman for 8 hours, what you gotta do is you take a steak, and then you absolutely drench it in ice cream. And this will give you both the short energy of the steak and the long energy of the sugar and the fat of the ice cream. And then after you have been going for 7 hours, you must smoke meth.
We talked about that?
I don't remember this at all. Are you sure?
Because
I don't think I'd be stupid enough to say that sugar would be long energy. You know what I mean?
I think words just got mixed up on that one. But
yeah, I fucked up the bit, but that was a bit.
Really?
Yeah.
We didn't talk about like injecting Viagra into the cow before it slaughtered anything.
Okay, speaking of slaughter. Claude.
Okay.
I say that with confidence.
Of a man who has studied bovine biology.
Yeah.
And who is very familiar with Viagra. Nah, I'm not. Anyways. So, Ronald.
Yeah, sure. So, it leads off with the narrator. And the narrator kind of just talks about the series as a whole. I don't remember everything he said, but he talks about it being episode number 7 and how 7's lucky. And how sometimes... what exactly did he say? He said sometimes, like, luck isn't always what you expect. Or something to that effect. And...
He was like, yeah, artists... have to be, wait, maybe this isn't what he said, but wasn't he like, artists often have to be prepared panty price?
Yeah. One of the runners they tried to do, like, Edward, this has a horror host. We've talked about these a little bit. A lot of old time radio shows will have a horror host. They're usually, you know, well, they range a lot. Sometimes they're really aggro and threaten the audience. Sometimes they're pretty chill. This is a pretty chill guy. He's just supposed to be a creepy dude who knows a lot. But the runner they set up through the entire first season was numerology, where they would go in and just say, well, in the science of numerology, the number of our episode represents this or that. And numerology is, of course, I think it's like astrology, kind of, where you can find a numerology book that will say anything represents anything, sort of similar to how you can find an astrology book that will say that any sign represents anything. So it's a very strange conceit to me, because it's sort of just like, well, here's some ancient lies for you and the theme of our episode. He suggests that this one is going to be mostly centered around sacrifice and what the artist has to give up to be lucky.
Right, which, yes.
Weird.
Which it doesn't really have anything to do with luck, so it was kind of a weird... it was kind of a weird runner. It was kind of a weird introduction to the episode. They did talk about sacrifice. He did talk about sacrifice. I didn't really understand the link there between luck and sacrifice. But regardless, it kind of jumps into the episode. I mean, he gives a little brief introduction that the two main characters are artists, and they're breaking out into the French countryside to try and pursue their dream of becoming successful. And to become successful, sometimes you have to sacrifice things.
Oh, there's one thing I'd like to say, but I'm sorry to keep interrupting.
Yeah, interject as much as you like.
None of the characters, like, it's set in France, right?
Yeah.
None of the characters actually have French accents, aside from an art dealer who has maybe 3 lines. And then I think the girl, although the girl is doing that Z instead of TH thing, so I think she might actually be doing a German accent. It's very strange that we're in rural France around the turn of the century and everyone's speaking with a fairly plummy British accent.
Yeah, I just kind of assumed it's like, oh, this is translated. This story is translated. Because,
well, you know, that was the weird thing that I did notice that. I did pick up on that. And I was wondering, like, you know, Eddie Izzard has that bit about how in American films, all the bad guys always have British accents.
Yeah.
And maybe they're just translating that to British radio drama where all the bad guys also have British accents. I don't know. It was kind of jarring at first, though. I was sort of like, is this... Like, the other thing that was going on was, like, what are the British assumptions about France, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could talk a little bit. I have some other stuff that we can talk about after the summary. But, like, what exactly are they assuming about this French village? Is it uncouth for the British actors to try to put on, like, a silly French accent? Are they trying not to alienate people? Or, like, I did think that was a curious move, and I was wondering what was behind the choice there.
I actually consulted a text I have called the Listen in Terror, which is kind of a scholarly guide of old-time radio, but it also goes into some depth about that. It's by Richard J. Hand, if anyone's curious looking into it. They tend to do some background, and I was curious if they talked about the accent. He doesn't. I find his actually found his analysis of this episode fairly unedifying, but, you know, whatever. It is the only book of its kind, though, so even if I don't like the analysis, it's still the best analysis that's ever been done. But I think what's going on is probably just that a French accent is an accent that is very difficult to do without coming off as quite comical.
Right.
So probably if, you know, oh no, hurrah, you know, whatever. Imagine I'd actually done a French accent instead of Dracula. it probably wouldn't have hit as hard. I was trying to remember if there were any other of these that have foreign accents in them, and it's been too long, and I have since I've done a listen through to really know either way. It is still an interesting choice. I got over it pretty quick, but it was still something to think about.
Yeah, it wasn't clear right away if it was like these two are English guys who are in the French countryside, or if they're actually French. And I think throughout the story, it's revealed basically that they are French. At least it seems like they are, because they're from Paris and their family lives in Paris. So I assume that I kind of assume that it's like, you know, they're probably speaking French and this is all just kind of translated. And so the accent's translated too. But it was kind of weird, because it kind of left it open to interpretation, because I could totally see English artists going to France to get inspiration. And that would kind of change the tone of the story a little bit. But
I think Antoine, at least, is definitely French, because he mentions that Marcel mentions at one point that he comes from the best family in Paris.
Although, yeah, I mean, both of their names are French.
Oh, their names are almost comically French. We got Marcel and Antoine.
Antoine.
So although this was written, this was written for radio, right?
It's an adaptation of Peter Gallagher wrote, I think, like 7 or 8 of these, and he would always adapt his own short story. But so he.
Why don't they just change where it was if they didn't have? If they didn't plan on,
I think
French accents.
Well, I think a little there, Claude. When we finish the summary, and we're talking about France. There might be some reasons for that, but also just England doesn't really have the whole like itinerant bohemian artist wandering the countryside thing quite as much as France does. That's not like as much of an archetype there, I do not think. Although Claude, you might know more than I do about it.
No, I think you're right. I think he's like what it's trying to capture is that sort of like end of the 19th century. Aestheticist art market, because like the art market in France really was thriving this way that it wasn't quite thriving in England, and that was one of the sort of points in the story. Like at one point, one of the artists, I'm jumping on the summary, I'm sorry guys, at one point one of the painters says, I have the technique but not the passion and the soul. I'm just going to be a bourgeoisie. I'm just going to be a patron of the arts and not an artist. And that was kind of like what was going on there. Like one, dude, y'all said I could digress. Sorry. One of the, like, all right. The reason there are so many French impressionists is because, I mean, there's a philosophy behind it. There's, you know, got to capture the light at this time and to do the paints, and you can break it down scientifically by the color and all this other stuff. But at the same time, a lot of what was going on was sort of the market, right? So you could differentiate yourself with a style. And that's what a lot of the Impressionists were really doing, was kind of like differentiating their individual style so that they could sort of develop a brand, develop the name. So, you know, I'm sorry, I'm digressing here, but like that, I think what they had to set it in France because it had to have that marketability in order to thwart the kind of marketability by the sort of revelation at the end. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay.
Makes sense. Yeah. A bit of art history worked into there. Yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense to me that, I mean, I feel like just some of the elements of the story work based on the geography and, you know, they just moved it to, I mean, not even the art history part, like if they moved it to London, I guess I don't really know, but I don't know if there's like, you know, like an English countryside that is kind of the same kind of unknown for the writer as like the French countryside, which is kind of the fear in this story.
Yeah.
So anyways, I guess back to the summary, let's jump back real quick.
Let's actually say a thing that happened. I apologize for throwing.
I mean, we can digress as much as we want, because you know that's mostly what this podcast is about. So, I'll run through it somewhat quickly, and then we can kind of talk about stuff. So Antoine and Marcel are in the countryside. They're kind of like looking around. They're having fun. They're kind of horse playing with each other, and they cross a river. And they see this farm, and they hear some pigs, and so they're like, maybe we can get some food here or something, and maybe figure out where this road is going. And so I think it's Antoine who originally goes up and talks to the farmer.
I think it might be Marcel. I think it's Marcel initially. Not that it matters that much. And then Antoine's hanging out in the background, because remember, there's, when he goes up to the farmer, the first thing he notices is the farmer has a pig that he's hanging up, and he's essentially cut its feet off. And he, of course, objects to this because he's a good person. And then Antoine is sitting in the back sort of going, yes, but there's a certain beauty to its suffering, don't you think?
Yeah, Antoine's all weird about it. He makes it weird.
Oh, okay, that I guess
he
that
makes it weird, not the guy torturing the pig.
Oh, and the farmer.
Farmer makes it weird. Antoine makes it erotic.
So. Yeah. So Marcel goes up and asks, you know, where does the road go? And the guy gives these really cryptic answers, like the road goes nowhere, which really doesn't make any sense. And then he asks, you know, like, what's the best way to get back to town? And the farmer tells him the only way is to cross the river. And he thinks about asking about food, but like he sees this pig getting kind of butchered in a really kind of evil way. And I think he thinks twice on it and kind of backs off. And so he goes back to Marcel, goes back to Antoine, and tells him, like, this place is awful. Let's get the hell out of here. And Antoine has spotted a young lady who's hanging up some clothes or something. And basically says, like, oh, wouldn't she be a great art subject? And Marcel's like, not really. I don't really see what you see in her. You know, there's tons of things that we could paint. She doesn't mean anything to me. Let's leave. And Antoine basically says, I can't leave. I'm bound here. I don't know why, but I'm going to stay. And Marcel says, well, there's no way I'm staying, so I'm going to leave. And they kind of part on acceptable terms. But Antoine asks, you know, go to my dad and get some money for me and bring it back before 2 weeks is up. Well, I guess I skipped a part, because Antoine goes and talks to the farmer and makes a deal and gives him a bunch of money. And he asks Marcel to go to his dad and bring back a bunch of money before the 2 weeks is up.
And the farmers are charging him an exorbitant rate. It's all the money he has on him, together with a gold pocket watch and a gold ring. And this is like apparently a rundown. Like, I was picturing it at least as essentially the Sawyer farm from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know?
Yeah.
So it's
honestly a horrible deal. He's charging him a bunch of money for no lodging and some food.
What's up,
essentially.
Claude?
Oh no, but like, before we move on, was everybody else creeped out by the sounds of the pig?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
They did excellent Foley work on this one.
It was almost overwhelming. Like, I could, like, you can't quite pay attention to like all the details and the wheeling and dealing of what's going on, because there's this horrible pig squealing in the background and you're just, ugh. But yeah, I think the Texas Chainsaw Massacre farm kind of captures that aura. Yeah.
The other thing that I've noticed here that interests me is that in a more conventional story, it would be that Antoine had seen Annalise. The girl's name is Annalise, and fallen instantly in love or lust with her.
Right.
But he never quite says that. And she is described by Marcel as being too heavy for grace and too dull for conversation. So it's not like he suddenly saw, I don't know, you know, Scarlett Johansson or something, and he's like, oh my God, I found this uncut gem in the rough, and I'm going to go, you know, impress her with my sophistication. There's something much weirder happening that I don't think we ever really get, like, a full answer on what it is.
Yeah, and I think that they kind of hint that he sees some authenticity in, like, this woman, and it's kind of like, you know, he's out in the countryside, and this is what he imagined going to the countryside is, like, something totally alien to him, and he's trying to, like, discover that, I guess. But Marcel's not really interested at all. He's just, you know, that's
he's
not
like,
really
fuck
why
this
came.
Noise, I'm out.
Yeah, it was more like a vacation for him, I think.
Yeah, he says at this point that he has had enough of, like, trying to be an artist, and he's going to just go take a job with his rich father and be a member of the bourgeois, and it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, we should all be so lucky.
Right, yeah.
Well, I love how blunt that was. Like, I mean, that was almost comedically blunt. Like, it was sort of like, here's the stereotype, blah, I'm gone.
Yeah, you know? Like, you know how other stories have subtext? We're just doing text right now. You can have some subtext later, but not right now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and it definitely felt like Marcel was already kind of, maybe, he'd already kind of committed to this. He never really felt that he was a true artist. And you kind of feel this, he kind of, you know, explicitly says this later, but...
Yeah, because he was thinking about food when he ran into the farmer, you know, like...
Right, yeah, he didn't really care about the farm. Yeah, exactly. He was like, I'm trying to ask about breakfast and trying to how to get home. So, I don't know, kind of interesting that Antoine really wanted to see what the farm was like and really wanted to explore that, and Marcel was just kind of interested in walking around the countryside, maybe doing some backpacking, essentially. And so then it kind of cuts to a little while later, and Marcel is back in Paris, and he's talking to Antoine's dad, who's kind of like your typical rich, but like a father who's very expects a lot out of their son. And he tells Marcel, like, oh, can you just convince Antoine to come back and be good like you are, since you just took this job as a clerk in a business? And he talks about how you've got to work your way up and kind of experience the business from the bottom so that you can run it from the top.
In this dumbass sinecure job he's got, where he'll be running the place in 6 months.
Yeah, right. And, yeah, so this little aside, and he tries to get money from him, but he doesn't get any.
His father is, like, a very much the stereotypical businessman, to the point where he's like, you know, art is fun as a hobby, but where's the money in it? And you kind of get the sense that if Antoine could actually make money, he wouldn't give a shit about the art either way. There's a little bit of talk maybe about it being disrespectful, but I think ultimately if it were, you know, if he actually thought it was a viable career, he wouldn't care. But as it is, he's just like, nah, you're wasting your life. This is stupid. Come
yeah,
on.
And I thought it was kind of interesting too that he's, you know, he says art's a hobby and, you know, you can't make money off of it. And then he says, and then they say something like, oh, it's almost as bad as music, which I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
he did say that.
He says the music hall, which I think is actually kind of sort of almost acting, too. It was.
Oh, okay.
Essentially, my understanding is that it was a place where, like, poorer folk would go and there'd be kind of like song and like comedy acts, essentially. And you could, like, spend, you know, an hour or so in there for a fairly small amount of money. And it was possible to make quite a bit of money doing it, but it was also intensely disrespectful and regarded as, like, one step above prostitution.
Yeah. It's kind of like vaudeville kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Except this was before, you know, we had made vaudeville into, like, legends, where now you think about an old vaudevillian and you're like, yeah, that was a respectable thing. At the time, everyone was like, no, this shit sucks. You're bringing dishonor on your family.
Okay, well, that kind of makes more sense, because I was like, you know, I would have thought that when I heard music hall, I was thinking, like, concerts. And it's like, you would think a musician, I don't know, maybe not by a businessman, but anyways. And so that's kind of an aside. I guess that just kind of gives Antoine a little bit of backstory. But then Marcel kind of comes back. You hear him, like, waiting across the river, and he meets up with Antoine, and Antoine clearly looks.
One thing. He says he's wading across the river in a full, like, three-piece suit. It's like, I mean, I get that you sold out and you got money now, but you got to get some appropriate clothes if you're going to go, like, tramping around the French countryside and going to horror farms.
Yeah, it really made no sense why he would wear a suit out there. An overcoat, I guess.
Yeah. He's just like, hey, you know, you people who I regard as subhuman brutes, I'm going to show you that I have a lot of money, and I know you have a little bit of no regard for human or animal life whatsoever, so this will end well for me, I believe.
I think that's his cool new identity.
Yeah, I think...
Guy who wears an overcoat everywhere?
Hell yeah.
I think he honestly believes that his suit will make him, like, easier to command respect around these guys. Throughout the rest of the story, he really does believe, like, oh, whatever I say will happen. Like, they can't talk back to me.
At a certain point, he's like, or what are you going to do? Hit me with your stick? And he says it, like, dismissively, but I'm like, wait, why wouldn't they hit you with their stick?
Yes.
They got a stick, and you seem like you're probably not that good in a fight.
Yeah, you're wearing a suit, dude. You just walk through a river in a suit. Like, you're kind of an idiot.
I mean, have you seen that Jackie Chan bit where he beats the hell out of the guy who's wearing a tie? I bet it'd be like that, where they just keep, like, using your suit against you.
Yeah. So he meets back up with Antoine, and Antoine looks terrible. He even says that he looks terrible because he hasn't been sleeping very well, and that he hasn't really been comfortable. But he said the art's been coming really well, and he shows some sketches to Marcel. But Marcel doesn't seem very... didn't seem very impressed by the sketches. And then he says, let me introduce you to Annalisa. And so he takes Marcel over to Annalisa, and, you know, he says, like, oh, nice to meet you, Annalisa. And he's like, actually, I just call her Lisa. And so I was like, okay. Nice to meet you, Lisa. And she talks, like Lawrence mentioned earlier, she talks with a little bit of an accent, maybe slightly German. I was almost reading, like, I don't know, Ukrainian or something, but...
It's generically foreign in a way that might make sense to a British person who hangs out with more continental Europeans, but to us, it's pretty bewildering.
Unless, yeah, it's pretty...
Claude?
Oh, no, sorry, I didn't mean to step on you, but yeah, that was another question that I had, like, is she supposed to be from, like, the German... speaking section of France, or sort of like that border section? Are they trying that was another question that I had, like, what is the expectation for this particular character having this particular accent? Are we supposed to believe she's from this particular place? If so, what exactly are we supposed to think about that? Right,
this is sort of a flaw, I think, or at least a difficulty in the story, because especially now you're supposed to sort of center the person the trauma happens to, and she is ultimately the thing, the trauma, and we really never find out what's going on with her. We know she's apparently an orphan, that she has suffered some kind of injury and walks with a limp, and that they think she's probably not French. They find that out not because of her accent, though, but because she's got Annalisa, named Annalisa, which I do think is a German name, although I'm by no means an expert on that.
So, like, yeah, that's, like, what is that supposed to signify? Like, everything is sort of working by these broad stereotypes. We got the broad stereotype of the bourgeois businessman, the broad stereotype of, like, the sellout wannabe artist, the broad stereotype of the cold, icy aesthete. Like, what is this supposed to signify? That was one kind of thing that was sort of impeding listening. Though I would still say that you should go listen to this. And I thought... maybe they had... Okay, I'm going to try not to spoil this. I thought the suggestion was that maybe they had already done partially to her...
Yeah, fact that she limps. I kind of thought it was a misery sitch, but it could also just be that, you know? Like, I do have a theory on why it's important for her to be an orphan, which we'll get to in about a few minutes, because I don't want to step on Ronald's summary, but
right.
I think that, yeah, to spoil it for the viewers a little bit, I think it functions very much the way the word step does in pornography, because there's just one line they don't want to cross.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that is. Yeah. Ronald, I apologize.
No. And like, to add to what you guys are saying, like, I think the accent really did... it threw me off as well, and the only thing I could kind of read into it was maybe it's like And I don't know how this works historically, but like some kind of human trafficking kind of situation where like he's from some other country and, you know, was kind of abducted.
I guess there is the archetype of the mistreated, like, essentially adopted daughter. But yeah. Again, there's just, I dearly like this story, but there is very little on the bone as far as Lisa goes. And she should be the center of the story, but she kind of isn't, weirdly.
Yeah, and there were some real questions about, like, what actually she was doing. But I guess we'll get to that.
Yeah, sorry.
I did want to ask y'all's opinion about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question, because I don't think it's very clear. But so Lisa's introduced, and she has this accent, and, you know, she says, oh, I've never been to Paris. She didn't even really seem to have heard of it. And she said she's never been across the river, which makes her accent all the more mind-boggling.
Yeah, and when she's talking to Marcel, she's like all weird about it. I don't know.
What do you mean? Yeah, can you explain?
Just like super terse and like embarrassed almost.
Oh, right. And he says something, and Antoine says something like, oh, she's just shy when she first meets you. But now she talks to me after she's gotten to know me better. But yeah, you're right. She's like, yeah, she's barely speaking of anything. Like all one word answers, and kind of everything she says is really cryptic. And then all of a sudden, like, you hear some yelling from inside the house. And
they literally yell the word suey, like you do when you're calling a pig.
Oh, is that what that was?
I didn't know that.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I guess that's what they say. They say suey, and she says, I've got to go. She kind of just, like, it sounds like she goes totally blank, and she says, I have to go. And Antoine says, really, do you have to?
And she says, like, yes, I have work.
Yeah.
Yeah, and her demeanor, like, totally changes. She's like a Manchurian candidate.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And then she kind of leaves, and Marcel's like, you know, rightfully so, what the hell was that? What was that about? And Antoine kind of just brushes it off at the time. And then they kind of have a little discussion about, like, oh, hey, did you bring the money from my dad? And he says no. And then Antoine shows him his painting. So he'd shown him some sketches already, but then he's like, let me show you this painting.
Oh, what, one thing, though. So before they get the painting, show him the painting. Marcel is incredibly dismissive of Antoine's plans. Antoine wants to stay on the farm and make some cryptic thing about, like, you know, I want to be here. I think, I don't know if I can leave here. I don't know what I would have to do to stay. And Marcel suggests, hey, if you come back, you can take a job with your father. You can save up some money. You can get a little apartment in Paris. You can get Annalisa out. And Marcel said, or sorry, Antoine says, no, that won't work. But he can't quite explain why. He offers some, like, objections, you know, she can't walk and so on. But Marcel figures out solutions to all of them. But Antoine ultimately just says she can't leave and can't explain why. And it kind of almost reminded me of, well, Ethan Frome in particular, but a naturalist novel where the characters are trapped in a location because, like, not because of, well, there will always be a physical impediment to them leading, but the real thing that's going on is just the, because of the convenience of the story or of the genre or something, they are not allowed to leave. So obviously I went back to Ethan Frome because that's the one I always think of for that.
Yeah,
also,
yeah.
I was trying to pull a big literary reference for Claude. Trying to show off a little.
It's kind of interesting because Antoine says, like, oh, she can't leave. And he's kind of saying this, you know, like he knows something.
Yeah. Because on the way there, Antoine's like, don't look at the sun. They're terrible people. Like, so he knows something's up.
He says one of the most horrible things I've ever heard a character say. He says, this family is terrible. The father looks like an ape. The children are seldom better than, or scarce better than the animals they tend. And the firstborn, any God-fearing family would have sold him to his circus long ago.
Jesus. God. Oh, yeah. And yeah, that's right. And I remember when I heard that line, I was like, oh, there's going to be more with the firstborn there, you know, like we're going to hear more about that character.
I thought in a more modern thing, they would do more to like make the family maybe not sympathetic exactly, but at least explain what their deal is, because you can't have a character say something that horrible about people with and not want to sympathize with them. And it's so weird that that's like the only like flash we get of like, I wonder if maybe Marcel and Antoine are assholes and this family's just like rural people trying to do the best they can.
Yeah, right. Well, and like they kind of give that flash, but then yeah, you're right, they just never really revisit that.
And the few times when the farm family seems to be motioning at it, it's very clear that they're making excuses for themselves.
Yeah.
Well, that was my question, is like, when we finally get the reveal, what exactly, that's what I thought was so unnerving about this, was that we don't even really fully understand, or at least I didn't fully understand what exactly the deal was, because there was a deal that was made, but how could he be the one to make it, and then what... I don't know. It was very confusing.
Was Antoine sort of responsible for what happens to Annalise ultimately? Or was this just always going to happen and Antoine just had the good or bad luck to be there when it did, depending? And you can kind of wonder on it either way.
Yeah, it's unclear.
It's a luck thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have some ideas on that, but... Yeah, let's get to the twist and then we can kind of talk about
it.
Or it's not really a twist, I guess just a reveal.
Then there's a climax.
Yeah, and so
I love my sex tape. High five! I high five myself. You guys nice all heard work. It. I deserved it.
Yeah, I can. I'll be your second on that.
Thank you, Ronald.
Veto.
Damn it! Fuck! I should not have given you absolute veto power. Hey, it's so, right in the podcast charter. It's a real problem for me.
So Antoine and Marcel are. Kind of Antoine takes Marcel back to the where he's been sleeping and wants to show him his painting, and as soon as he reveals it, Marcel suddenly changes his mind, you know, he totally changes tone because it's so amazing that he's like, yeah, okay, you've got to do this, you've got to stay here, I'll fund you, that's why I took this job, so I could become a patron, and I'll give you everything that I've got, and I'll even sleep here so that I don't have to pay for a hotel, so you have some extra money. And then Antoine says something like, this painting got away from me a little bit. It doesn't capture the full essence, but see if you can sell it.
He said he was going to destroy it. He built a painting so good that it makes a man completely give up his dreams of ever being an artist. Shows that all of his attempts at being one were pretension and vanity. And then he's like, yeah, I was going to burn it, but I guess if you could sell it, that'd be cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Because Marcel's like, I truly understand that I was never an artist now. I never had the heart for it. Just by looking at this painting, he just thinks it's incredible. And Antoine's, you know, he's like, you know, this one's not that great, but see if you can sell it. Maybe it'll get me a little bit more money to last me a little bit longer here. I just need to stay. So I need you to go into the city and sell this. And then that night, so Marcel spends the night there. And that night you hear like a kind of whispered discussion between Antoine and Elisa. And it's basically about Annalisa saying, like, I don't know where I went. Basically, I remember talking to you and then walking off. And then I, you know, everything goes blank. And then I'm just, and then I was somewhere else and exhausted. Like, I had been, you know, doing something all day. And he says that he had followed her and she just kind of hides in this bin or something.
It was like they dig big like holes in the ground and fill them with like hay and coal and stuff as a way of cooking meat. And my understanding was that she was digging down and hiding in them.
Okay, yeah. And he says you just go hide in there for hours and then you come back. And she says, "Well, that doesn't make sense. Why am I exhausted? And why can't I remember it?" But Antoine keeps insisting that, you know, like, "Oh, nothing happens. You're fine. Don't worry about it." Until suddenly there's the yelling again. What was it again, Lawrence? It's Sui?
I think this time it might be something different, but the first time they are yelling Sui, which again, how you summon pigs.
Calling a pig. So, yeah. Like, the suggestion is that she's being hypnotized, right?
I guess. So, the first time I heard this, I just didn't know what the fuck was going on at all.
Right.
Then, when I was reading that Listen in Terror book, he offhandedly mentions that she is serving as the camp... well, I think he uses the word whore. I would use sex worker or something. Except that doesn't quite fit because it's not happening with her. You know, sex work is fine if the person is wants to do sex work and she clearly doesn't. Later things... So I guess the implication is that she's been with this family for a very long time and they are treating her essentially as just another piece of livestock, except a piece of livestock that they can fuck, right? And then she's, like, repressing the memories because they're so horrible and it's sort of a mercy. But I'm not... That is certainly what the characters in the story think is happening, but there is... It's such a strange idea of a thing that could happen that you kind of wonder if there's more to it.
Well, that was the thing, because doesn't Antoine... I'm sorry, I get my names mixed up. I think it's Antoine, the city boy.
Yeah, or Marcel,
excuse me. I like that. That's right. These are so stereotypically French names. I keep getting them confused.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they went to a restaurant, the waiter would be named Garçon.
Exactly. But he goes and talks to the patriarch, the father, and he intimates that, you know, they're using her as a sex worker. They're sort of abusing her or raping her or forcing her into prostitution. And the father says, "You've got it all wrong. That's not what's going on. And in any way, fuck off," right?
Yeah, he gives kind of an ambiguous answer of she has a job. So yeah. That is certainly the obvious, like, it's a surface level of assuming that's what happened, but this story is so full of, like, weird, maddening gaps, because it's told to us primarily through the perspective of the person it doesn't actually happen to, Marcel. So right. we don't know. The explanation that he gives to her of what she does, assuming I'm right that she's burrowing into the pit that they are eventually, that they use for smoking meat, is also very weird, because that, I mean, not to spoil it too much, but that prefigures what happens to her. And then Antoine will later claim that he knew what was going to happen to her. So there's just all these, like, little maddening things, and it never quite adds up.
Which is why I thought the process was already underway, given the limp.
Yeah, but then... I don't know. Let's finish the story, and then we can stop hedging around it. I guess going through our episodes, I've noticed that a sort of a tradition of them is we will constantly hint about, like, well, we'll talk about it later, and then we kind of never do.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
I hope we don't do that. Well, that's how it goes. Because there's a lot of fucking meat on these bones.
I might it.
Well, I mean, M. Night Shyamalan, they all build to the twist, but the twist actually is there. So we're often like, we'll talk about it after we say the twist, and then it's like if The Sixth Sense ended right after he saw, like, that weird ghost in the house, and then you never found out that Bruce Willis was a ghost. Just like, nah, he had a bad night, and that's it.
But that wasn't the twist.
The twist was that he was Bruce Willis the whole time. Okay, this is a very strange call. Did you know that after The Sixth Sense came out, there was a series of young adult novels continuing the story?
No.
Maybe you should review one of those.
Yeah, they had centered, I don't know if he was writing them, but it centered entirely around whatever the kid's name, and he would just go around and, you know, the ghost would help him solve mysteries.
So it's like kind of a Scooby-Doo type thing, except the other way around?
Yeah, it's like if the ghosts were trying to help you catch the old man or something.
It's kind of like that TV show Medium.
Except, again, on Medium, are there actually dead people?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure she talks to ghosts to help solve crimes.
Because there are also a lot of shows where the person pretends to talk to ghosts and then solves crimes other
means. I'm pretty sure she's actually, like, a medium in that one. It's not, like, Psych.
Or, iZombie? That's another one where she pretends to be psychic.
Wait, what?
I thought in that one, doesn't she eat brains to get people's memories?
Yeah, but she pretends to be psychic, so she doesn't have to say she eats brains. Oh. Now, Claude, are you unfamiliar with the television show iZombie?
I apparently am. This
okay. We got to get okay. So it's a show about a young, attractive woman. You know, she's got her whole life together. She's got an attractive boyfriend. She just graduated from med school. Everything's going to be great. And then she goes to a house party one night and she gets bitten by a zombie. So she becomes a zombie. But the zombies work different, where if they eat brains regularly, they're fine. So she goes and gets herself a job as a coroner so that she can just eat people's brains. And then she discovers that when she eats people's brains, she gets their memories. So she starts using it to solve murders.
That is high concept. How have I not? Okay, I'm going to text my wife real quick because I think she needs to watch this.
And for some reason,
they like they use the title iZombie as like a reference to iCarly.
I think it's I comma zombie. So it's like I am a zombie.
But is it? I thought it was like I capital Z O M B I E.
Fuck, I don't know. Oh, and also she pretends to be psychic, so she doesn't have to tell people she's a zombie, but can still explain why she gets weird things.
That is wow.
I love that premise, because I will frequently describe it to people and they will assume that I am playing a weird joke on them.
Like, that's not real.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd think. I actually haven't seen it. I've just heard about it.
I've seen all of the first season. It's actually the show that made me really like the song All You Zombies by the Hooters. Oh, another weird bit of trivia. So you know the song All You Zombies by the Hooters, where they appear to just be recounting the history of Israel for some reason?
Nope.
You don't know it.
No.
Well, look it up at some point. But I was checking the IMDb trivia, and apparently the lyrics came to the dude who wrote it in a dream, which means that it's a rare song where no one on Earth actually knows what it means.
Oh.
Anyways, you guys want to actually talk about the thing we're here to talk about?
Yeah.
The new Apple products.
The Apple zombie.
Yeah.
It's got a much slicker interface than the Windows zombie, but you can't sideload apps onto it.
Anyway.
Brilliant. Yeah.
All right. Marcel goes to confront them. And this is where we get the immortal, what are you going to do? Hit me with that stick. And I'm like, yeah, probably. It sort of seems like you're being an asshole to him and he's got a stick.
Yeah, but they don't actually, as evil as they seem, they actually don't seem at all hostile towards Marcel.
I mean, they're sort of low-key threatening to him, but that could just be that they all have deep, scary voices.
Yeah, I mean, they sound scary, but they don't ever say, like, oh, we're gonna kill you if you don't listen to us. They're just kind of like, oh, you're our house guest. We'll do whatever you want, but don't interfere with what we're doing. Yeah. Yeah, nothing is free here.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, that's what makes it so ominous. It's sort of like, okay, in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like the typical slasher film, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre isn't even a typical slasher film, right? But the typical slasher film is usually, you know, kids somewhere from outside go to some rural creepy place where they're not supposed to be. They're not exactly trespassing, but they're invading that space. And what they find is horrifying and creepy and drives them out and destroys them, right? This didn't have that same kind, like, there was a creepier vibe here. There was a creepier menace because it was sort of like, we don't need to drive you out. We don't need to do anything. We're doing this. We're going to keep doing this. You can tell anyone you want. You can come and go. It really doesn't matter.
Yeah, this appears to be one of those things. I don't know if it takes place in a world where there are no police or a world where the police are irrelevant, but certainly the idea of like, maybe we should go to the authorities with some of this, even in the denouement where you know, everything is revealed. Hell, we don't even find out what happens to the family, do we?
No, I mean, I always thought the implication was like, they're just there. It's like, what's going to happen? That's what reminded me of like some of the new French Extremity stuff. It's like, who are you going to tell? What's going to happen? There is no authority. There is no thing that will come in and step up and like assert some kind of idea of justice. It's just, it is. And I thought maybe that's why Like, there's something so creepy and horrifying about that, that maybe that's why they had to project it onto France. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, also doubling back, assuming I'm, she actually is, like, just, you know, sex work. Well, not sex work, sex crimes. That would sort of explain why she has to be an orphan, I guess. Because they're just like, now we're drawing the line at incest for some reason. Although, why would they draw the line there? Sorry, I just remembered I'd been thinking that.
I think because the, like, okay, we're back to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, I know there's a sort of reading of the Texas Chainsaw. I'm sorry, I hate to keep jumping in here. I know there's a reading of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre that is kind of like viewing it as not exactly satirical or satirizing, but critiquing the idea of the modern self-contained nuclear family.
Because the Sawyer clan is like this monstrous version of it almost.
Yeah, yeah. And like that ethos of the family as the institution is heavily ingrained in America. Sorry, I'm going off.
That does make sense here, though, because the family appears to look out for itself as much as we see. In fact, the climax takes together at a gathering of the extended family. And on the other hand, at one point, one of them literally says that Annalise is property. So there's sort of this weird dichotomy where there's like absolutely, or well, we don't know, but they appear to be loyal to one another. But anyone else is not big, like maybe almost subhuman to them? Question mark.
Yeah,
or a thing to be exploited.
And I thought that's what was so creepy about this. Like, what's so primal about it is that it's like reducing all relationships to this insider-outsider thing. To this extraordinarily primal insider-outsider thing. You're either one of the family or you're not one of the family. And if you're one of the family, we got you back and we'll do anything for you, even if you are, like, you know, would best be served as part of the circus.
How fucked up must France have been if they're like, hey, here's how we care for people with who are differently abled or whatever, have different bodies, is you go to the circus, buddy. It's fine. It's kind of like universal basic income or I don't know, whatever. Go there. Do it. Come on.
Oh, man. Like, dude, our notions of human integrity are not the same as the 19th centuries.
That's fair. I don't know. Anyways, let's actually finish the summary. Come on. Let's do it.
Yeah, we're almost there.
I have faith
there.
In you, Ronald.
Okay, so he kind of goes and talks to the patriarch, and the patriarch kind of tells him like, you don't really know what you're talking about. She's doing work. It's not really any of your business. And we told your friend, you know, there's no free rides here. Like, everything is paid for, and we can't eat paintings.
Yeah, we can't eat paintings, which is a very important line.
Yeah, and so Marcel kind of leaves finally. And then he tells Antoine, I don't know if they talk a little bit, and then he tells Antoine that he's going back to try and sell his painting. And then it kind of cuts to back to Paris, where Marcel is talking to an art dealer, and the art dealer says, like, hey, this is really expertly done, but I can't sell it. It really has no value here.
He says that the painting, the things people like now are romantic images of tamed or nature rearranged and tamed. And then Marcel gets indignant and says, so you're saying this painting won't tell because it's true? And the guy's like, hey, I like this painting. I just, it will not sell in this market. I'm sorry, dude.
Yeah, and go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Nah, come on, Claude.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and I'm an art dealer. I'm here to sell stuff, not necessarily to appreciate it.
And that goes back to this kind of like, that's what I thought was sort of fascinating. It was playing up that stereotype of the aesthete, right? An aestheticism divorced from material concerns, divorced from moral concerns, an aestheticism where, you know, I think we're supposed to feel at this point in the story that the artwork is so good that it's a shame that it doesn't sell, and it's the corruption of the art market. It's the capitalizing on it, which is, you know, the real tragedy in the story or something like that at that point, right?
Yeah, it's weird because it's sort of a dichotomy of Antoine's work is too pure for this world. But on the other hand, the reason it's too pure for this world is because it's accurately reproducing the degradation and horror of the farm.
Yeah.
It's like a portrayal of this evil setting, and he's the only one that like really sees it for what it is. But yeah, I mean, I can kind of understand the art dealer's point of like, no one wants to see this man. Yeah. It might be really authentic, but it has, you know, nobody wants that in their lives. They don't want to see like this kind of like really authentic, but kind of terrifying picture of this woman who's essentially property.
People want shit to hang on their walls, not things to remind them that human life is essentially just sort of, you know, an animal that can walk on two legs and that there are any number of horrors and abuses that can be heaped upon it.
Yeah. Yeah,
like we're 60, 70 years out from Francis Bacon, but, you know, we'll get there. I mean, that's honestly what I kept thinking of throughout this thing. It's like, well, just give it to Francis Bacon and then, you know, it'll eventually sell, right?
Yeah. And so the art dealer says, like, yeah, you know, essentially, I'm not going to be able to sell it. So then Marcel, it kind of cuts back to him heading back towards the farm, and he sees Antoine across the river and says something like, what are you doing over here? And Antoine says, oh, I got kicked out. I didn't have any more money. Something horrible happened. And he sounds like really distraught. And
Yeah, apparently they set the dogs on him. But it's weird. The thing that seems to upset him isn't, like, trying to talk about the horrible thing, but the fact that they won't let him back. Like, he's almost in tears when he says, they won't let me go back.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And Marcel's like, you know what, let's go talk to him. They have no right to treat you this way. And obviously he's talking about, like, the part that they set dogs on him, and something happens to Annalisa. And so he's like, okay, let's go talk to him. Let's figure this out. And when they go across the river and no one's around, he's like, where is everyone? And Antoine tells him that they have some kind of family gathering. So they go up to the main house and he knocks on the door and he has to speak to the patriarch. And the guy says, you're speaking to him. And he says, well, what right do you have to, you know, treat my friend like this? And he's like, I have every right. We had an agreement and he knew what we said. And we met the terms of the agreement. We told him we can't eat paintings.
He makes a really interesting move here where he almost does the, like, I'm just a simple country, you know, horror farmer, and we don't have any of your big city ways. We say we do what we say, and we say what we do. It's almost like he's making fun of the guy for being a corrupt, like, big city guy. Although, considering what we find out he has done, it is a joke, I think, albeit one
kind of like probably it's honest, but not honest. Because like there's an implicit expectation of, you know, of certain manners and I don't know, certain ways of people acting that's not, you know, completely
not held up by this man.
And so you know, he says, like, you know, we met our end of the agreement. He's like, you know what? But I'll make you a deal. I'll give you some food for the road, and we're eating a feast of meat in here. And he like, and you hear like these really disgusting like meat noises. And he's like, here you go. Here's have some for the road. And he hands something to Marcel. And he's like, oh god, the grease is getting all over me or something. And then he starts freaking out really bad. Clearly something super wrong, and he's asking, like, what did you do to Annalisa? And it's revealed that that it was her arm that he gave her. Is that right?
Yeah, or at least her hand.
Her hand. And, you know, I guess the implication is that all the meat that's there was her and they're eating her, which, like, brings, you know, a new light to the we can't eat paintings. And the patriarch says, you know, Antoine knew what was going to happen if he didn't bring us more money. Like, he knew. And they kind of run out of there. Marcel runs out of there because it's terrifying. And he's really freaked out. But Antoine seems fine. And
delivers a monologue at this point. Yeah. And it's revealed that he is insane. Like, the things he has seen have broken him. I actually have some quotes from it.
Yes, please do.
So, Marcel, or Antoine, there is a terrible beauty in suffering, Marcel. Marcel, I can't believe you're saying this. You're mad. Antoine, you still have learned nothing. Well, you can stand before saints and martyrs and thieves on the cross, and you'll nod your head and cross your palms and on to the next. But could you walk by so calmly if you saw a young girl, her limbs broken and strung up by her heels and bleeding to death? Marcel, oh my God, you didn't even try to stop it. Antoine, an artist can only observe. And then Marcel, so your education is now complete. Antoine, if education is what you want to call it, I glimpsed the poetry in human degradation. You see, I knew all along how it would end. I was fascinated, obsessed by the prospect. Do you know she never uttered a sound? She just hung there, slowly bleeding to death. And now, God help me, I must lead others to the same trough of blood. I must relive the same degradation and suffering again and again and again. And then the episode just ends. The man in black gives a little summary about how that you can still see the mirror painting, but it's cursed. Antoine leaves his family and dies in a bar fight a couple of years later. And apparently Marcel's still around because he's the one who told the story to the man in black. And yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this is kind of coming full circle to what kind of drew me to this is that whole idea of the amorality of aestheticism sort of opening itself up into horror, right? Like late 19th century aestheticism, the kind of parallel to it was the Gothic horror. So, like, if anybody's interested at all, the guy who really sort of articulated it for the English was Walter Pater. And Walter Pater was an art critic, and he was an Oxford Don. And he wrote this, this treatise, was it Studies in the Renaissance? It's usually just shorthanded as the Renaissance. And he writes a preface and a conclusion where he basically says that life is nothing but sensation, and that the goal in life should be to get as much sensation in as possible in order to intellectually evaluate what sensations are worth it and what aren't. And at the end, he like in the last paragraph, he basically uses art as a safety valve. Like, okay, the easiest and best and most lasting way to get sensation is through art, right? But he leaves the door open for all sensation. And so anything, he basically says that anything can be an aesthetic experience. Now, all right, there's a lot. He had his letters burned at his death, which was sort of what you did in the 19th century. And there's a lot of expectation or a lot of suggestion that he was maybe covertly homosexual in a time in which that was literally illegal. So a lot of the aestheticist stuff gets quoted at, or it gets coded as LGBTQ because you can see it as a justification for other kinds of sexuality that are not, you know, heteronormative, right? On the other hand, the Gothic also sort of circulates around there because he kind of opens up this idea that anything can be aesthetic. And that's where I sort of thought Marcel was going with it at the end is, you know, to really, really sort of understand and to embrace the true icy aestheticist vision, you have to find the pleasure in all things, even this degradation. And so, like, that becomes his artwork.
The most important lines he says, probably, if there is a way of understanding his character other than he saw fucked up shit and went insane, is he's talking with Ant or Marcel, and Marcel is like, well, I envy you. And Antoine says you shouldn't, and Marcel's like, why? And Antoine gets apparently a very grave look and says, because often the things we want are not the things that make us happy. So he is like sort of, found this kind right. of like perfect artistic vision in this way of working out all of his ideas. But, you know, it also involved watching a woman he apparently kind of had the hots for, you know, get butchered like a pig.
But it was also like that was also there from the beginning, though, right? Like when he's standing off to the side, there's that hint of that right at the beginning that, you know, the bourgeois dude is... you know, so kind of disgusted by this place, and this is a ratty dump, but he's standing off to the side kind of calmly observing the squealing pig, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, so creepy. You know, yeah, I love it.
I think this thing is ultimately designed so you can't really put, like, it together, like, figure out what's going on with almost any of the characters except for Marcel. Like, yeah,
Yeah, it's, I mean, go ahead. Actually, finish your thought, and then I want to...
Like, if you want to put this as a story of, like, Antoine, you know, like, there's those stories about people who, like, they want to go out and experience something, and then they experience something, and it destroys them in some way. This could be that. This could be him achieving, like, a perfect artistic, like, vision, and, like, he's not happy, of course. He dies in a bar fight later, but, like, actually perfecting his craft and destroying himself in the process. This could be, like... If you really wanted to, this could even be like Lovecraftian horror. It's just, it's happening like on the very, very edges. The fact that there's a painting that low-key drives you crazy. Well, not crazy, but low-key kills your soul a little when you look at it. And the fact that there's a human sacrifice, both mean you could pull that if you wanted to. It's really interesting. I wish I could read the short story of it. Anyways, Ronald, sorry.
No worries. I wasn't interrupting you. So yeah, there's another part that we didn't really talk about in the summary. Where Annalisa is talking to Antoine and says something like, I don't think I exist to anyone else. In fact, I don't think I ever existed before I met you. And she's just kind of talking about her own kind of like existential dread of like, she doesn't really understand what her, you know, is she even a person when Antoine's not around? Like, until he saw her, she didn't really feel like a person. She felt like, I guess, more like livestock. And I think throughout the story, there's a lot of references to her being very like porcine, like from the beginning when it's like, oh, she's dull and she's heavy set. And like the original quote of, oh, there's beauty in a pig slaughter, being recalled after you find out that she was slaughtered. And it's kind of, it honestly made me think of like kind of a vegetarian perspective on farming, like, because pigs are obviously very intelligent, and she's just like, she's just they kind of portray her as not, you know, not necessarily like very smart, or she doesn't really do much, but it's still like kind of horrifying to see her like cut up and eaten in front of everyone, and this whole family is kind of just treating this as like it's totally normal. It's like this totally normal thing to butcher and eat this woman.
They don't even try to hide it. They've committed cannibalism, and they're like, yo, you want some, dude? It's pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. And which like doesn't really make any sense until you think like, what if she was just actually the pig? You know, it doesn't really make sense because she obviously talks and she has an accent, she has a name. But
like to them, at least she is the pig. They don't,
right, yeah.
Of course,
that's exactly how they that's exactly how they see her. And in a lot of ways, in their minds, it's the same exact thing. And to Marcel and Antoine, it's kind of like, oh, you know, this is a person. There's this distinction here. And it kind of starts breaking down, like, where really is the line? I don't know. So that's kind of what I was thinking about when, you know, you see this butchery is like, it's somebody who's seeing it from, you know, somebody who sees this is like, how different is this for us to kill and eat pigs than it is to eat other humans, you know, that we don't see as valuable? And I don't really understand Annalisa's origin or anything, but that's kind of the thing with like farms, right? Like these pigs come from anywhere. No one really cares about what they're doing during the day. No one really cares about
they occupy a place where they're sort of part of the family, you know, especially on a farm because you're taking care of them every day, but they're sort of not. A little bit similar to how you might view an orphan in the old days.
And she says she'd never cross the river.
Maybe
a pig would never cross a river. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyways, we should go around and give everyone one last crack at final thoughts. And then we're running quite long, so I think we should go straight to final recommendations and then cautions. So I guess the one thing I wanted to point out is the horror for me in the story, I mean, there's a lot of places, but one of the things that Ronald was touching on, too, is that it really resides in the fact that they have created a situation where this woman is nothing but livestock to them. The only difference is that they'll have sex with it before they butcher it. And that was pretty upsetting to me because, you know, I'm vegan. And, you know, it was like sort of homing in on something is a bit of discomfort for me. There, that is also a theme that shows up on Fearon 4 at least one other time. There's a play called Survival that ultimately hinges on cannibalism and a person losing the ability to tell the difference between food and people. And that is legitimately the most upsetting thing I've ever listened to. I think I tricked Ronald into listening to it once, and he like didn't want to talk to me for a day afterwards. Serves him right for listening to Lawrence. Anyways, Rahul, do you have anything else?
I just have like questions, I guess, but I guess we probably all do, like things that weren't really explained in the story, probably on purpose. Yeah, that's it. That's it for me.
Ronald?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I've shared all my thoughts on it. I did really enjoy it. There are parts of the story that are missing that maybe are present in the original short story and we had to cut out for the audio. So I would be interested in seeing the original story as well.
Yeah, and Claude?
Yeah, I'd want to see the original story too. I kind of want to track this down. Like, I still can't. I'm trying to do the math on this. Like, I'm still not sure what the deal was. And, yeah. You know, they keep talking about this deal. And it's like, okay, so what are the terms? What exactly is going on? Yeah. Because they make such a big, you know, it's sort of like country authenticity as opposed to city sophistication where there's no, you know, you can't weasel out of this. This is what it is. But then what is it, right? And, yeah. And the other thing, like, you know, I think you're right, like, connecting, the story is connecting Annalisa to the pig from the beginning, right? Like, there's some subtle hints that she is in some ways connected to that, but she's got this weird limp, and they never really sort of explain it. That's what I was like, well, and there are all these suggestions that they're abusing her, so, like, you know, I thought maybe had they already eaten part of her leg?
Yeah. You wouldn't be able to walk at all, right? In that case,
I mean, who knows? What if they'd like bitten off her foot or something?
Yeah,
or
yeah,
like
right?
A couple of toes. I don't. I mean, I'm not an expert on what parts you can eat of a person and have them still walk.
Toes?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, there's not much meat there.
They're like we're gonna treat these like Vienna sausages. Looking at my toes right now. They're a good appetizer, but they're not gonna like fill you up.
Well, then, like, there's still this other sort of gap here. Like, what are they doing? It seems as if she's being hypnotized and doesn't know when or where she is. Is she being, like...
Are they actually sexually abusing her, or is it something weirder? I mean, even the thing he's describing where she's rehearsing getting cooked and somehow forgetting about it would be pretty... I mean... It's not as viscerally horrible as the other thing, but it's still like, wow, what the fuck?
He's really, the farmer guy is really into, like, deals, so I kind of want to say, like, they made a deal of some kind, but I'm just
maybe the fact that they keep saying, we can't eat paintings, they were taking money from him, I guess he could have been paying to extend Annalisa's life, but I don't, that's an unsatisfying explanation to me, though.
Yeah, that's what... That's like, all right, if he's, that was one of the suggestions to me. And if he is paying to extend her life, it's just for the sake of completing a painting.
Yeah, like, and he's trying to get enough preliminary sketches that he can draw her getting butchered. That was the painting he was building to, right? We're all in agreement.
Right. Yeah, I think so, yeah. It seems like that's what he's talking about at the end.
And that's why he has to lead other people there, because that will be the culmination of this.
But then he, and I guess the reason he's so upset is that he can't go back and get more sketches or something, because, I mean, he never actually does the painting, apparently.
Because he's not a good lore. He dies in a bar fight because it's like the end of The Wicker Man, the remake, and he's just not good at getting him back to the island.
Like, no, come on, dude. There's this cool farm. They got... I don't know. What do you like? Meat? They got meat. I don't know. And a shitty barn you can sleep in. And they charge you a lot of money. Come on, let's go. And the guy's like, no. And then he punches him.
Yeah.
Then he gets stabbed. The end.
He's just out there looking for German women with weird limbs. And he's like, come on, I got a job for you. You're not going to like it, though.
Well, I mean, so there's like a lot that's sort of left open for interpretation. Like, you know, I still think that there's some kind of... hypnotic suggestion or something, because she responds to Sui, or there's like this weird kind of way in which they broke her like livestock or something like that. It's something is going on there that's not clearly articulated. That's even more terrifying for being unarticulated. But for me, like, really, the scary, scary part of this was like the whole, well, where are you gonna go? You know, like, yeah. There's the lack of overt menace made it even more menacing.
Yeah, like they can
don't
leave at
need
any time.
To threaten you. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, I guess final things. Probably largely superfluous. I would really recommend this. There will be a link to it in the episode or show notes, and I would heartily encourage you to check it out. Even after our discussion, I don't think we hit everything, and even though we did, like, the acting on it is superb, and the sound design is something else. Yeah. Ronald?
Yeah, no, totally agree. Definitely check it out.
Raul?
What was the question?
Would you recommend this to other people?
Oh, yeah, I recommend it.
And Claude?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. It's great. If again, like, listening to everything we said, it does capture that vibe of a lot of, like, recent French horror films. Like, it's something that's hard to pin down, but it's that kind of rural isolation where there's a kind of lackadaisical feel on the on behalf of the perpetrators, because there's no thing you can do. It's just, we're gonna kill you and eat you. Do whatever, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Run to another farm. They do the exact same thing. Yeah. What are you gonna do?
Except they have two weird sons, not just one.
So you better watch out. It's a dreamy French countryside.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's do recommendations and cautions. And Claude, would you like to go first?
Somebody else go. I'm still thinking.
Okay. Ronald?
Sure. Okay. Recommendations. Actually, well, let me do a caution first. I just watched something that I wanted to caution, and now I forgot what it was. Sorry, it's quick transition here is making me forget. I guess generally, I've been watching, so as a recommendation, YouTube just put up like a lot of free movies. And some of them aren't so good, but some of them are pretty good. Like, they have A Brother, Where Art Thou up there, and I'm just going to go ahead and throw out a recommendation for that. I love the Coen brothers, and it's free on YouTube. So, like, go check it out if you haven't seen it, especially. Cautions? I don't know. I don't really have anything this week.
Okay, Raul?
I only have a caution. I don't remember if I did it last time, honestly, but I saw Wonder Woman 1984, and I did not think it was good. That is it.
Okay.
That is the end. That is the beginning and the end of my impression of that movie.
I thought it
just
it
sucked.
Yeah. Claude, you ready or should I go?
Yeah, I think I'm ready. I also don't have a recommendation, but I do have a caution. If you're mowing the grass, watch out for yellow jacket nests.
Oh my god.
Wait, I feel like lawnmower versus nest, lawnmower wins.
But I think the problem is that the lawnmower defeats the nest, but then the bees are angry, or hornets are angry and homeless.
Oh yeah, but you can just lift up the lawnmower, dude, and just, you know, just blast him out of the sky.
No, yeah,
Rahul, you appear to have confused a lawnmower with a flat cannon again. And I have very, very grave concerns about your ability to ever be a homeowner if you keep making these mistakes.
Oh, no. Yellow jackets burrow into the ground. So
really?
Yeah. I didn't know that until I was kind of like
on top
walking.
Of it.
Yeah. And well, you know, I was past it and I was like, why are all these flies like suddenly landing on me? I had to find some kind of new innovative way to mow over the nest without getting stung.
And how bad did you get stung?
Not so bad. Like, one stung me through my shoe, and then I just sort of like steered away, and I can go faster than they go.
Holy crap. How did Maz do that? What kind of shoes are you wearing?
It was like some crappy talk shit. Well, then, like that was a couple weeks ago. And so I had to strategize. That was 2 weeks ago. I had to strategize, like, how do I get over this thing? And, I guess this is a recommendation. Okay. So, my warning is don't, or always check the ground before you're mowing, but I have to mow the grass. Like I moved from a place with no grass to a place that's nothing but grass. And some nosy neighbor actually sent the city. I'm sorry. I'm getting in. Dell said I could digress.
You're getting into the weeds about the weeds.
Yeah, exactly. Some nosy neighbor actually called the city on me because we let the grass grow so high, and I nearly got fined $200. And so I was like, while my wife was trying to find somebody to cut the grass, I got a cheap lawnmower and just like went out there and went to town. So I've got to keep the grass down. I've got to cut it like every two and a half, 3 weeks. And this place that we're renting has this huge yard, so I got to cut it in quadrants. And so I was cutting the quadrant at the end of the property, and that's when all the yellow jackets came out. So my recommendation for dealing with it, you could be, you know, wise and get an exterminator or try to, you know, kill the nest or do something like that. Or you could do what I do. The last video game I played was Assassin's Creed 4, you know, the one where you're a pirate. Mm-hmm. And I developed this technique because you're on this boat and you have to sort of attack these fortresses where, you know, they're shooting cannons at you and stuff like that. And so if you speed by really fast and then just stop for a second and shoot and then just keep going and then let them settle down, turn around and come back, that actually works for yellow jacket nests. So what I did was I took the lawnmower and I just ran over it, right? Sped past it and got way further than the nest, and all the yellow jackets would come out and be confused and like look around like who's doing this. And I'd mow another part of the yard and like wait 5 minutes and then speed past again and cut another, you know, section like close to the yellow jackets. And it's exhausting, and you might throw out your back, but you won't get stung. And so over time, you can clear out.
It sounds like a risk. Like, it still sounds like a risk to me, man.
I like that you're just doing straight
for the rest of your life.
The sweet strategy.
This is weird, man. Like, okay. So
yeah, it's like they just, like, it's like a game. They just forgot, you know? Like,
it's like they do. I mean,
bad AI, and you're just exploiting.
Like GTA AI. Exploiting reality right now.
But then I don't exactly know what's going on. Like this weird neighborhood that we're living in, it's nice enough, but everyone here is retired. And so they keep having like these neighborhood events and we go over and I try to bring my kids and it's like a bunch of like 80-year-old people. And the last one I went to, everyone was complimenting me on my lawn mowing skills. And I can't tell if they're trolling me, you know? So
did they say bless your heart, you're so good at lawn mowing? Because I believe that's a giveaway in the South.
No, they didn't say bless your heart. So I don't know, they were like saying how I was putting them to shame and all this other stuff like that.
Do you have any of them played Assassin's Creed? Because that might be a hint.
I don't know.
Like,
well, I mean,
that's a strategy.
You're saying they're 80 years old, so perhaps some of them lived Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, it could be, right? Or they might be Knights of the Golden Circle, you never know.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm gonna hit you guys with a couple of recommendations. First off, their listenership is much bigger than ours, but I really enjoy the Knowledge Fight podcast. It is released twice a week, and every episode the host will go through an episode of the Alex Jones Show. They pull clips of him saying wacky or insane or false things and deconstruct them, and the overall effect, because they're so much more thorough and effective in their debunking than Alex is at mounting his insane arguments or weird claims, it's sort of like watching a man like walk into a thresher over and over and over, except the man is a bad person who deserves it. So it's pretty fun, although it is sort of also a commentary on the limits of debunking, because Alex keeps putting out shows. It doesn't matter how often they're like, you know, you probably didn't get offered the leads in Guardians of the Galaxy. That doesn't make any sense, dude. Why would they give it to you? That is a thing he said.
Man, You gotta have some confidence.
just lie and say that Disney wanted me a hard 45-year-old man who is morbidly obese.
45?
I know, right. It's astonishing, but he's been, I guess it's just drinking and Adderall abuse has aged him so poorly. He's in his 40s, man. It's fucking crazy.
My sister is older than Alex Jones.
Yeah.
That's not right.
And then second, I've been watching this show called Kevin Can Fuck Himself. It's on AMC.
Oh, yeah.
And the gag of it is, I think you heard of it from me, but the gag of it is that there is a woman and her husband, and they live in, I think it's Baltimore, somewhere on the East Coast, a kind of rundown area. No, it's somewhere in Massachusetts, because they all have the Massachusetts accent. And whenever the husband is in the scene, it is a wacky multicam comedy. And whenever it's only the husband is not in the scene, it is a single camera, like, anti-hero driven drama about the woman trying to figure out what to do with the fact that she's married to this horrible, he's not abusive exactly, like physically, but he's incredibly selfish because he's a sitcom husband, and she's like trying to figure out how to navigate that. And it's the other weird thing is I was expecting it to be incredibly meta because, you know, it's switching genres and she would like gradually become aware of like the limits of, you know, or of her situation and try to figure out how to navigate it, you know, the rules of the sitcom world or whatever. But it's not that at all. It never comments on its form whatsoever in the episodes I've seen. It's really something. I think it's like the highest concept television show to come out in a very long time, and I recommend it pretty highly. And then as far as cautions go, so I recently started trying to get into Breath of the Wild again, and I still do not understand why people like that video game. I'm glad that people are happy with it. You know, you never want to like take something away from it. But the fact that you have to go grind those stupid puzzle dungeons for like 40 hours before you can accomplish even like the most basic act of navigating the game world and like cross a small lake without drowning is really weird to me. I guess it might be that I abandoned the like critical path you're supposed to be on really early because I don't like Nintendo's writing. It's that really twee bullshit where, you know, every fourth line is, oh, 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 that they do. So maybe there's like some point in the main quest where they just hand you a pile of stamina and suddenly you can like not worry about, hey, if I try to climb more than a foot, I'm going to die. But I don't know. I just don't get it, man. Yeah. So that's about it. Oh, one last thing. We actually have a person who has something he could plug. So, Claude, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Only my podcast. Yeah, if you're at all interested in literary stuff, it's called The Cannonball, CannonBall. We're trying to work through Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon, me and my co-host, Daniel Doherty. And the you know, we try to break it down and give you background information on the works and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, we're also trying to articulate kind of our affective response to it, because that's one of the things that I think gets missed in a lot of, I guess, professional academic type stuff is like, yeah, this can make you feel things. So we try to talk about that. But if you're interested at all, check it out. If not, yeah, that's fine too. Life is short. Go enjoy yourself.
Yeah. So thanks everyone for listening, and I hope you guys have a great 2 weeks. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you so much for having me on, man. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's been great, Claude. If you'd like to recommend an episode of Old Time Radio for us to listen to, send us a question for the mailbag, or a pedantic correction, you can reach us at radiobadtime@gmail.com. Our theme music is Finger in the Bottle by We Ashore Dedicated off their album No Ski Here Okie Sap. Thanks so much for listening.
Well, I was gonna gather it. Finger in the bottle. Now